From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump's mental health status has always been in question as the nation reels from 2 years of abusive rhetoric, incessant lying, violent threats, and shameless narcissism. Most Americans who have watched his presidency unfold with horror have worried that we are being led into a dark abyss by a madman. In a powerful book collecting essays and assessments of Trump's mental health by dozens of experts, my guest Dr. Bandy Lee lays out the dangerous case of Donald Trump. Dr. Lee is an assistant clinical professor in law and psychiatry at Yale School of Medicine. She was previously chief resident at Mass General and a research fellow at Harvard Medical School. She's also been a fellow of the National Institute of Mental Health. And she's edited the New York Times best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. The book is just now out in its second updated and expanded edition, featuring essays by 37 experts. Welcome to the program, Dr. Bandy Lee.
Thank you for having me.
So I, of course, used some colloquial terms that I know psychiatrists and mental health experts would be loath to use, but I'm a civilian and I can say madman because to me, as an ordinary American, it appears that we are being run by a madman. Our country is being helmed by a madman. Why have there only been dozens of psychiatrists and mental health experts willing to speak out about something that seems apparent to the rest of us? Explain to us what kind of has held people back a little.
Well, first of all, related to that, I have to make clear that my views are my own and I don't represent the views of my institutions. Well, of course, you can imagine it's a difficult issue to discuss to start with. And it's not just a few dozen. It's actually thousands right now in just the organization that I am now leading, the World Mental Health Coalition. Itself has thousands of mental health professionals who are all concerned about this. What has been inhibiting us more has been what is called the Goldwater Rule, which the American Psychiatric Association, since the Trump presidency, actually changed to turn it into a gag rule. We call it that because before it prohibited only diagnoses of public figures. Now we are prohibited from speaking about any aspect of any kind of a public figure, even in the case of a national emergency.
So the APA has a rule in place that it has only strengthened against people speaking about, against a mental health expert speaking out about well-known figures without, you know, being their actual, without having to assess them personally. So now they've strengthened this?
Without examining them and gotten consent from them. So you can imagine that a diagnosis would be hard to make without having all the information, including a personal interview. But they have expanded it to include any comment whatsoever. We have found this to be politically responsive because it happened a couple months after Mr. Trump's inauguration. And we opposed this, and that's why I organized the conference that led to the book in early 2017, a conference to discuss the ethics about speaking up. And we decided that it was part of our ethical duty to warn and inform the public, as well as protect public health and safety, that we decided to put out the book. And the book is actually just a small sample of the thousands of mental health professionals who have since come forth. As you can see, as you have noted yourself, it had become an instant New York Times bestseller. It was highly demanded upon, which led the publisher to request an expanded edition. So we added 10 more mental health experts who explain how the psychological dangerousness that we initially saw has now translated into social, cultural, and geopolitical dangerousness.
So let's talk about some of the issues. There are many, many different aspects of the story in the book, each essay taking on a slightly different aspect of it. But I'm wondering if you can start by explaining to us the dangers of the impact on us as Americans psychologically, being victimized by the president's actions. It seems to me, as a layperson, to be this classic case of abuser versus victim.
Yes, and there are a handful of authors who address that issue, that having a president with his characteristics is like being in an abusive relationship. There are many ways in which we have been affected. According to the American Psychological Association, stress levels are highest in the nation's memory, worse than World War II, worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis, and worse than post 9/11. And also, according to the American Psychiatric Association, we are much more anxious now than 2 years ago, up to 70% more anxious. And so those are some of the effects that this presidency has had. The book itself outlined three themes: that basically he was worse than people were suspecting he was, more impaired, that is, and that he would grow more dangerous over time, and that ultimately he would become uncontainable. Now, the reason why we made that prediction, which is more based on probability, was that if we do not intervene and do not treat the person the way it's outlined in the medical standard of care, ultimately he would worsen the mental health of the population to an extent that the nation would have a hard time responding to this presidency. And one of the ways in which that has happened is by the nation becoming exhausted. Another way is by the nation becoming more, taking on more of his symptoms and characteristics. In other words, believing, taking on his false beliefs.
So the impact, not just on those people who are sort of victimized by him or who watch him in horror, but even on his own supporters.
Yes, exactly. In fact, you can say that all are victimized by him, because what you're seeing is mental pathology. What we as mental health professionals find to be our duty is to identify what is abnormal and pathological from what is healthy decision making, because there's a wide range of human variation within normalcy. And so what is abnormal would become harder for the untrained person to detect. And so that's where our expertise can come in. To be useful, to warn against signs that indicate pathology, that require intervention, require an evaluation and treatment, and that if it's left untreated, it will come to, you might say, you know, gradually infect the public in a way where the public will become less able to take care of itself.
Let's focus on Trump himself for a bit. One of the things that we know about the president is that he is basically a perpetual liar. Media outlets have continually tried to keep track of his lies. He has lied more than any president in memory and perhaps in history. His lies are very easily verifiable. You know, it's very easy to verify that he is lying. We often hear this term pathological liar. Does that apply in a sort of clinical sense, as far as you can tell, to Trump?
Yes. Whether he is lying, in other words, falsely fabricating beliefs, or whether he truly believes in what he is saying, the level of falsehoods at this point would be considered pathological either way.
And how does that then impact the people that he especially sort of targets? I mean, for example, I'm thinking about the situation in Puerto Rico, where Trump just did not want to accept the fact that 3,000 people died and has decided, no, that didn't happen. He has decided that $91 billion was spent in hurricane relief when only a few billion were spent, and $91 billion is actually how much damage was done. I mean, no matter how many people have pointed out that he is bandying about a completely wrong figure, he has stuck to that and then made his decisions on holding up aid to an entire island of people who are American citizens based on this lie. The impact on the victims is huge.
Yes, that is right. He's having real-life consequences and very grave consequences, which is why we have considered this presidency to be dangerous. Now, dangerousness is about the situation, not necessarily the individual. So Mr. Trump not in the office of the presidency may not be as dangerous, but granted as much power as he has been granted, and without the moderating forces around him, he is very dangerous. And we are seeing some of the consequences, the fact that aid would not go to populations that he does not believe deserves aid, and his assessments, you might say, of reality depend more on his internal thoughts, emotions, and needs rather than the outside world. And that is one of the reasons why some of these very deleterious actions are happening. Others might include creating thousands of orphans at the southern border, U.S.-Mexican border. And still others might be the 800,000 federal workers who suffered under the longest government shutdown that he had effectuated.
What about white supremacists who support him and who, you know, have literally gunned down people?
That's right. One of the reasons why we felt he was dangerous was not only because he was cognitively impaired and emotionally impaired, but also because he has a tendency for violence. As you have noted, he is verbally aggressive. He has boasted of sexual assaults in the past. He has endorsed violence. He has shown an attraction to violence, and he has incited violence in his followers. And what you're seeing in terms of the white supremacist killings, the recent mosque shootings in New Zealand cited him by name as an inspiration, that they have common purpose with Mr. Trump. And you might recall the pipe bomber who sent 16 different explosives to prominent Democrats and Mr. Trump's critics. And then there was the synagogue shooting, the greatest anti-Semitic event in the nation's history. All of these are directly refer to Mr. Trump or his conspiracy theories. Also, ABC News found 17 different court cases that where defendants have said that Mr. Trump was their direct inspiration. But this is actually only the tip of the iceberg. As a violence expert, I can tell you that studies have now increasingly shown that social, cultural, economic, and political factors are far more influential even in individual violence. So the vast majority of violent acts are hidden and individual based, not necessarily mass shootings. And we now know that gun murder rates are the highest in decades. Also, suicide rates are the highest in decades and have gone up exponentially under this administration. This is what we would expect from someone who is openly a proponent of violence.
Let's talk about his narcissism. Trump has often been found to speak about himself in the third person. He posts things on Twitter. He talks about how he's the best. He's this stable genius. He has talked about his own genius and intellect. He's talked about basically being, you know, the best thing that ever happened to America, to Puerto Rico, to you know, many, many different demographics. Is this narcissism also pathological? And also, how does it then impact his supporters?
Certainly, extreme narcissism has been a feature of him, to the point where we would consider it of pathological levels. Again, I have not examined him and so would not make a diagnosis. And in fact, there are more than one or two syndromes that could cause extreme narcissism. And so I wouldn't diagnose it, but we know that these levels are pathological and therefore it could be a cause of violence. For example, when his inflated self-image would not match reality, and he is facing a lot of shame and humiliation, that is when our country would be in greatest danger.
Really?
We have to keep in mind that this is a man who has under his sole authority the ability to launch thousands of nuclear arsenals. And he also has every other presidential power, the ability to launch a war, an attack, to incite violence among his followers. He has the bully pulpit, if you will. And so he has a lot of power and authority. And this is a very dangerous situation.
Let's talk about the daddy issues, if you will, that Trump also seems to harbor. He has talked about his father, Fred Trump. He's lied about his father, most recently talking about the fact that his father was born in Germany when he wasn't. And of course, Fred Trump started the real estate business that Donald Trump then took over. How do you explain or assess that relationship with his father in making Trump the man he is today?
I personally have not so much researched his personal family background, but of course a lot of information is already out there. And
one of the chapters in the book you edited is literally called Trump's Daddy Issues by Steve Rubella, who's also an MD.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yes. So there is a psychiatrist who has done a great deal of study of his relationship with his father. Some of the most significant episodes that he relates include the fact that during his eulogy to his father's death was all about bragging of his establishing Trump Place, that his father was not able to do. And there was really no room for grief or tears. And that is a very odd parent-child relationship. And we know that many of the risk factors of extreme narcissism come from problems with the parent-child relationship.
So let's pick up on something you just alluded to earlier, which is that here's a man with huge amount of authority, he is at his most dangerous when he has sort of been shamed or exposed. So that leads to this question of what happens if he is impeached or if he loses re-election in 2020? Could we see a situation, do you fear a situation where Trump will not relinquish his power?
I think that is more likely than not, given that this is a man who has an insatiable need to fill his sense of self-worth. This is what we're seeing, actually. Someone who is lacking the basic sense of self-worth and self-love, if you will. And most of us have the resources to cope with negative news or criticism or not being the winner all the time or being in the most powerful position in the world. We are able to cope with reality without those things. But here we have a man who we can see from his constant need to attack those who criticize him and his inability to refrain from mocking them, and then who seems to undergo a lot of stress when there are signs of impending humiliation, such as the lead up to the midterm elections. He has become much more fierce in his rhetoric, in his conspiracy theories, and his even call for violence and violent rhetoric. So we know that if the actual results were to turn out to be what he greatly fears, we can expect to see a reaction that is much more severe than what we've seen so far.
What you're describing is really quite depressing to imagine that one might be able to undo the Trump presidency by simply humiliating him, and it could have the opposite effect. The bigger worry then is not just Trump, but Trumpism. Even if we have another 4 years of Trump at 2020, unimaginable as that is, the effect that he's had on his supporters, and there's this persistent base of support that Trump enjoys. You know, even when he loses popularity, there's always this floor of support of a few, you know, tens of millions of Americans who back him no matter what. That legacy he will leave behind in the United States almost seems like he kind of has multiplied into millions of mini Trumps that are a real long-term threat and danger to the United States long after Trump leaves office.
Well, I wouldn't say long after. In fact, removal from office is one of the main necessary interventions when we see a phenomenon that is called shared psychosis. When there is a sick individual, without intervention, without treatment, and the sick individual is sent back to their family, it's not the sick individual who becomes healthy when they're exposed to healthy family members, but rather the healthy members who take on the symptoms and sickness of the sick individual. That is in the absence of treatment. So what to do in that situation, first of all, is to remove the sick individual and actually quite dramatically, the family returns to normal. So then you give the sick individual the proper treatment, you educate the family members, and then prepare them for receiving the sick individual. And once, you know, strong interventions are in place, the rest of the family will not succumb to the illness that the sick individual is suffering from. So you can analogize that situation to the entire country. When there is affliction in the presidency, then the entire nation is like the family that is affected by this one sick individual. And without proper intervention, which we have not had, in fact, if anything, the political system has been enabling his illness, and those who have been keeping a modicum limitation on him have been stripped away. So more and more his personnel actually take on his pathology.
The sort of staff at the White House, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, but even maybe Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, some of the top-ranking Republicans who you might expect have been a little bit more reasonable or rational, but seem to back this man no matter what.
Yes, and so things not functioning properly actually help pathology to spread further. If there's corruption and an attempt to make use of a person's mental vulnerabilities for the sake of passing extreme laws or policies that would otherwise not pass under a normal president, it might seem like there are advantages, but ultimately the pathology is usually destructive no matter what you do. And without proper treatment, the natural course is a great deal of damage and destruction. And in the organism, it causes death ultimately. So there's really no good that is likely to come of this. And John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, is someone we have worried about because he also is in line with the kind of violence proneness that this president has been exhibiting. So it might be easier to get into wars with other nations. This is the way in which psychological dangerousness, unchecked, has translated into social and political dangerousness.
Well, finally, Dr. Lee, I'm wondering if there's a danger that when we talk about these issues, we also end up stigmatizing those who struggle with mental health. I mean, we want to lash out at the president, and I called him a madman earlier in the conversation because, of course, we're all so traumatized, including myself, by the impact of his actions. But, of course, mental health struggles are a real issue. Those people who struggle with them on a day-to-day basis and who have tried to get help or maybe don't have the resources for help, certainly need all the support they can get. And I just want to make sure we don't end this conversation without emphasizing the importance of requiring treatment and resources for all of those among us who struggle with mental health issues, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, stigma comes from a lack of knowledge. And so when there is stigma, we need to really talk about these issues in detail. And if we did talk about these issues, we would know that individuals with mental illness are by large actually more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators, and in fact are more prone to being violent against themselves than others. And so the really dangerous individuals are more often, as in terms of whole groups, those who do not suffer from what we traditionally call mental illness. So there's no reason why this should stigmatize those suffering from mental illness in general. Also, individuals with mental illness are not necessarily unable to do their jobs and are not dangerous. in their jobs. In fact, I think a Duke University study showed that nearly half of all presidents for the past 200 years have had some kind of mental illness. So if it's treated properly, in fact, there are many individuals, even those suffering from severe mental illness, who, when they are treated properly and are responsible and know the limits of their illness, can actually, in many cases, even use their experience as strengths. For example, Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill, both suffered from severely debilitating mental illnesses, and it's thought that their afflictions made them actually better leaders. They were able to be more empathic and more resilient when dealing with crisis situations.
Well, Dr. Lee, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for putting together this really important book. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I just want to add that these situations are not new for mental health professionals, and there is a way to solve the problem. Even a president deserves medical standard of care, and it's about time that he receive a proper evaluation.
My guest has been Dr. Bandy Lee, assistant clinical professor in law and psychiatry at Yale School of Medicine. She's the editor of the book we've been discussing. It's a New York Times bestseller called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. And the book is just out in its second updated and expanded edition, featuring essays by 37 experts. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Are You With Sonali?